Hi there, and welcome back to our podcast series, The Road to Permanency. I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in. Today we will be touching on part five, talking about LGBTQ2S plus and Indigenous rights. If you like what you hear today, then you should definitely tune in to part four, where we give some previous context and also discuss this topic. Research shows that there is a disproportionate amount of Indigenous youth being overrepresented in the child welfare system. Today, we are hoping to shed light on this, give some advice, and advocate about it. We will also be talking about LGBTQ plus and being two-spirited and what that can also add to the mix. So we have two special guests today. We have Chris and we have Kagan, and I'll just have them introduce themselves. So first up, we have Chris.
Hi, my name is Chris Moore. I'm in grade 11. I go to Superior Collegiate and Vocational Institute. I'm 16 years old. I'm turning 17 next month.
Thank you, Chris and Kagan.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Kagan Beardy. I am 19 and I'm from Thunder Bay, Ontario. I have been a part of the foster care system almost in my entire life. And I've been living independently for a little over a year now. And I'm here to share my experiences and answer anything and try to give some advice. Thank you for listening.
Awesome. Thank you. So Chris actually just was in a video that was very inspirational. Everyone should go on YouTube and watch it. So after watching that video, Chris mentions in the podcast not needing validation of your gender identity from your parents. How did you come to this place, Chris? And do you have any advice for youth currently experiencing issues of validation, specifically regarding their gender identity?
I came across it when my father and my mother first came back into my life after like 10 years of silence and me not seeing them at all. And I told them that I prefer a nickname that I like to go by, and that sometimes I like my pronouns to be he, him, they, them, or even she, her. It just goes about wherever. And my father, yeah, I'm not on good terms with him. He often, I guess that's what you call dead name. He says Kirsten and all the little nicknames he used to give me when I was like six. And I voiced my, I'm saying, hey, I don't like that those nicknames. I don't like being called back. My name's Chris now. And he's like, okay, my bad. But then he goes, it's very repetitive. I have to keep telling him, and then he goes, oh, okay, I'll respect that. And then he doesn't. And that probably happened about five times, and then I've just grown tired. I'm like, okay, whatever, you can keep addressing me as that. And for my mother, it's complicated. I mean, she tries, not hard enough. And I feel like it's especially more difficult for especially for the trans community with parents who will misgender them, give them the wrong pronouns, or dead name them. It's really frustrating and upsetting because one of my younger brothers is trans, and he sometimes vents to me about how a lot of his teachers, his friends, and some other family that he talks to would always misgender him and just go with his dead name. And it's stressful for him, especially when he's trying to find who he is and he's getting comfortable with transitioning, but there's always still those barriers that you have to get through. Sometimes those barriers are not really worth going through, especially if someone's really stubborn. Then you just want to move past that person. You don't need that stress in your life.
And that can be like really invalidating to like who you are and like your identity and your sense of permanency. Do you have any advice for youth in care who are currently going through this?
Honestly, I think people who are trans are really strong. They're strong-willed and they have a lot of spirit. And just don't let, I guess, your friends who don't really accept you, or family members, or your parents just put you down. It's just, that's who you are. If you're a guy, then you're a guy. If you're a woman, then you're a woman. If you're neither, then you're neither. It's simple as that. You don't need validation from others. All you need is validation from yourself.
I love that. Thank you, Chris. Mm-hmm. Kagan, can you describe your experience in care for us and how that was intensified by also being Indigenous?
I was put into care at a very early age. I believe three months after being born, I was put into care. And that is because my mom was, I would say, not really responsible for me at the time, meaning that she would constantly have parties and drink. And something that would happen was that if I was to be crying, my mom would play loud music over me so that she wouldn't be able to hear me. And I didn't know this until a few months ago. I was talking to my grandma about saying how when I was younger, I used to have these bad dreams where I was in fetal position inside this large drum, and it would sound like those big drums next to my ear playing over and over again. And as I was telling her about these dreams, she told me that story about me as a kid and how my mom would play like these loud music to, I guess, so she wouldn't have to deal with me crying. And I guess the reason why she would do that was, again, because she had me at a really young age and her parents didn't really like raise her, just because her parents was just coming out of residential schools. So they had all their trauma and issues from that and couldn't really take care of my mom. And with that, my mom had a very hard time taking care of me. So I was very quickly put into foster care because of that. Because of my parents wasn't able to take care of me, because her mom suffered so much trauma and pain from those schools. My grandpa, my mom's dad, also has a lot of traumas coming from that being from the 60s scoop, and he would all have all these stories and traumatic things happen to it. So I guess my family didn't really have or really experienced parental love or care, and that's something that's been going down for generations from what I've seen for quite a while now. And I feel like my situation is very similar to likely hundreds of other students across Canada. And something that I had to learn early was to understand the reasons why my parents were acting this way. I needed to almost put themselves in their shoes and get that it's not their fault that they don't have these parental skills, or they might not be as understanding as they want them to be. And it's something that likely won't really change because of that huge impact that their experiences had on them. So something that I've learned to do was tolerate their issues and to understand the reason they're not doing it because of some sort of inherent dislike for me. They're doing it because that's all they know. And that's something that I don't think is ever going to change about them. But I still need to love and care for them and to do my best to build the best relationship as I can with them, even if that may not ever be in the way that I want it to be. But I still need to develop these relationships, even though it may be painful to me. And that's something I had to learn and teach myself growing up, teaching myself how trauma affects people and how to talk to people like this, and that I shouldn't be upset when this backlash is on me, because it does happen, not because, I don't know. So I guess I can say the same for a lot of other students. We're putting a big impact on thinking on how to learn and understand this and how it affects people, and to not necessarily be super sad when things don't always go as right, but you still need to be there and care and love for them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. The egregious battle of racism and homophobia in being an Indigenous person who identifies within the LGBTQ2S+ community is discussed in the video. Can you explain more of your experience and shine light on this issue?
There was a lot of homes where I felt like I couldn't exactly express myself as a two-spirited person or as a gender fluid person, because obviously most of them were very Christian, and so they blame their religion upon being homophobic. And it's like, oh, that's against God, or you're sinning. It's like, just say you're homophobic and go. But there is this one home that I've been in, the longest home I've been in for 5 years, that I felt safe enough to say, hey, I'm two-spirited. And honestly, they were very welcoming because they themselves, they were lesbians and they were married for 3 years. And so I felt like, hey, this is a safe place for me to come out. So I did. And I was welcomed, and I was given resources and also like support groups that they knew about. But they also had like, they were very open about my sexuality and everything and identity, but I'll say that they had like inner racism to the point where they tried, I guess they really urged me to do well in school and just be quote unquote a normal person in today's society, because there is a lot of stereotypes of Indigenous people not going to school and they're homeless or they spend their money on drugs and physical substances. And unfortunately, that's true because of the racism we experience in the workplace, in schools, or even sometimes in foster care in the homes, that we just don't, we kind of quit on a lot of things. And it's very frustrating because you want to say something, you want to stand up, you want to advocate, but at the same time, you know you're just going to be silenced by people who clearly have privilege over you, whose voice will automatically be louder than yours, who will be heard more by people higher up. Sometimes I just kind of want to give up on that, that to stop talking because I'm not going to be heard. And it's very frustrating, especially when you're in a foster home where you're supposed to feel safe and welcome, where you're not supposed to feel scared every time you come home or every time you're doing something in the house, or you don't feel welcome in the house. And where honestly school, where you experience some homophobia and racism, feels better than being at home. It was very confusing for me. There was a lot of mixed messages I got from them. So when I, so like the second year in when I was living with them, I didn't feel quite, I guess I noticed, they, we noticed how I was getting attracted to boys' clothes, quote unquote, and how I was acting more masculine than feminine. And so they're like, are you trans? And I'm like, maybe. So I identified as trans for a few months until I decided, well, I like feminine things too sometimes. And so we talked about it more, and I did my own research at school because I wasn't allowed internet access there. And it turned out I was actually just gender fluid. Like, I like switched back and forth, and I'm just neither. And so I was like, okay, so that identifies this. They're like, okay, so that's good. And it's strange because they're really open about it. But when my younger sibling came out as trans, they said that they were doing it for attention and that they were just doing it because they were just problematic, quote unquote. And I was very confused by that because I was like, how, why are you open about me being trans when I'm actually gender fluid? And also when my younger sibling, they were like, yeah, I'm trans. And all of a sudden, you're just against it, like you're transphobic all of a sudden. And so it was very mixing, it was a lot of mixed signals from them. And it was like walking the eggshells every time, to the point where my youngest sibling who was living with me didn't feel safe enough to come out as trans to them because what they saw happened to their older sibling. And I still get angry about that today. You're supposed to be an open, caring space, and you're just making a kid feel unsafe just to express who they are. And yeah, it makes me angry.
Thank you for sharing that. I actually thought this question might be good to ask both Chris and Kagan, since we kind of both talked about it. So I just want to ask, what does cultural safety look like for youth in care, and what should it look like?
I think a lot of it does come well with that, because the values and teachings that you are taught within these things do help significantly when it comes to talking to your family and your elders, as you heard from Dominique's and Beth's stories and how their culture has helped them a lot when dealing with these type of things.
Do you have any advice you want to talk about in regards to culture safety in the home for youth in care?
I would just say to do things that you enjoy, things that bring you, things that you can do that you genuinely enjoy doing, and that's all I can really say on that, honestly. I would like to pass it on to Chris.
Yeah. I'm still in care, but right now I'm living independently. I've been independent for about 5 months now, but all those years I've spent in foster homes, I have never felt safe to express my culture. It was mainly because of the homes. They were racist or extremely religious, and they thought of my culture being quote-unquote savage. And honestly, I felt upset because I was really connected with my culture because of my grandfather before I went into care. And after when I learned of his passing, I want to be more involved in my culture to remember his teachings and kind of connect to myself, to the land, to everyone around me, and to him, to his spirit. But unfortunately, when like little 7-year-old me had to ask, hey, can we somehow get some sage? Can we get cedar? Can we get tobacco? Can we get an eagle feather for smudging? I was always turned down and often denied. You know, that kind of made a 7-year-old really upset and confused, because, like, why can't I practice my own culture while you can? Like, what's the difference? So after 8 years old, I gave up, because I was in another home where they were really strict and they weren't open about it. So I quit and I just let myself, I don't know, go to church with them or go to mass with them, whatever religion they had, because I was in their house, so it's their rules. And I felt like it would have been really nice to have more opportunities to go to powwows or to attend sweat lodges or to talk to elders at least. I think a lot of youth would appreciate that if these foster care agencies would offer programs like that or offer opportunities like that to these kids constantly. But it's also hard in Thunder Bay because I feel like there's not a lot going on, especially with COVID. But I always still see those one or two virtual gatherings for like heal and talk or just storytelling. And I feel like also what would be safe culture would just allow these kids to get sage or allow these kids to have tobacco or cedar. So obviously don't let them burn it alone, but obviously it's fire and it's a fire hazard. So adult supervision if they're at that age. Like, they're too young to do it by themselves. What I'm basically getting here is it'd be nice if there are programs that these foster care agencies could offer the youth in their care. Because a lot of times these homes won't let these our culture practices in their homes because they think it's odd or they think it's dangerous or they think, hey, this is wrong. And just give them a safe place where they can practice that and where they can connect and just opportunities to talk to elders too, because they're the storytellers and they know what's up.
Thank you, Chris. And I think me and all the viewers can appreciate you advocating for this. You know, this podcast does aim to be a platform for change, and we do want to advocate for things like this because, you know, I think there's definitely a major disconnect in the amount of education foster parents or adoptive parents or social workers are getting on how to deal with Indigenous youth and how to be there to support them and facilitate this huge intergenerational gap of trauma and culture, and something we need to actively work on restoring.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not continuing to repeat the same patterns every single.
Expanding on what Chris had said, I do feel that the school is a really important place for kids to engage with the culture fully. And that the decision that I had to make when I was younger was that I had the choice to go to a school called Pelican Falls, which is an all indigenous school made specifically so that students flying up north can have a safe place to learn and be away from the dangers of the large city and still be immersed in their culture. And at this indigenous run school, you were taught things. They had tons of cultural activities, but one of the issues about the school was that they didn't have any high level courses. Things like chemistry, math, and physics, they didn't have the capacity or the funding or teachers to be able to have courses like that. So they would only have one per year-ish. And they wouldn't also be able to support academic classes. So if a student wanted to go to university, but at the same time wanted to engage in a culture, they couldn't do both. They had to choose between one or the other. And for me, when I was younger, that was a very hard decision to make. Do I want to go to a school with all my friends and in a school that embraces my culture? Or do I want to go to or do I want to chase this higher education but forego my culture and go to a public school where they don't embrace my culture as much, where it's a lot less welcoming and cold? And making that decision, well, for me, honestly, it sucked having to choose between my culture or a higher education. And something that I wish I could have done is choose my that school beforehand, because I feel like even though I have learned a lot at the public school, I would have been a much more full human being had I went to a school that embraced who I was, my history, and that knew and respected my family's past, and that they knew the challenges that students like me were facing, something that most schools, I feel, don't put as much effort into understanding or being accommodating for. And it would be nice if this gap wasn't there. I would love the schools that embrace this culture to have the same, if not better, education as these public schools. I would have loved to go into that private school and still go to university. I would have loved to know that the students going to that school had the same education as I was going to a public school. And going to a public school for me wasn't the best thing because, there was very little accommodation or knowledge or I guess just acknowledging the fact that a lot of students there who were indigenous had these past and histories, not because it's their fault, but because they were born into families that experienced a lot of trauma before. So I would, yeah, I don't know, that's what I want to see later. I want that gap to be bridged, gap to be bridged one day, where either schools, public schools would be a lot more accommodating, more and helpful and culturally accepting, and or having indigenous schools be elevated to the level that public schools are.
Yeah, more funding needs to definitely be brought into education for these indigenous schools, 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's like this huge stigma and all these stereotypes, like Chris mentioned before, about indigenous youth not fulfilling their education, not continuing on with their education. But how are they supposed to when there's this disproportionate gap in the quality of education they're receiving? It's almost like dictating an egregious path.
And again, with culture, I feel like that adults should be encouraged to talk to younger people and to share their practices, and that more effort should be placed into creating workshops and other places where kids can learn. Because when I grew up, the only time I would really engage with my culture if someone else was there or taught me. And I didn't really have that growing up in my reserve because it's a very Christianized reserve where they didn't really do powwows. They had they sung about Jesus, and instead of doing ceremonies, they had these other things. And so I wasn't really exposed to a lot of my culture living in the reserve. And I would really only get that in my school where they had a in native language class, or where they hung up native things on the wall. So I feel like encouraging adults and other youth who do know these skills and can share, they should be encouraged to do so more so, and be given the platform and the resources so that they can do it. Because there is no shortage of people who are interested and want to engage in these activities, but were never given the chance to growing up in these in homes that didn't embrace it. And I think our culture is also really important because it does provide a lot of life skills that the students will definitely need, especially students in the foster care system, just because of what I would call that major drop in responsibility when you're going into high school. Because something that I think about a lot is how most students in the foster care system, or most youth in the foster care system, ultimately end up in the justice system, or end up in these precarious situations. And something that I think about a lot is that when you don't graduate high school or fail to get your diploma, the rates, the chances of you become going into these systems, the justice system, rises greatly when you don't have your high school diploma. Your chances of become stealing or going into these type of situations goes up so much when you don't graduate. And that's something that's really difficult for students in the foster care system. That's just because when they're in grade 12, usually when they turn 18, they are expected to be in grade 12, pass their exams, and go on to higher education. That is a lot of responsibility, and a lot of work is needed to be able to pass that gap or bridge in order to get your diploma. But something that happens at the same time when you turn 18 is that you age out of the system and you no longer live in these homes. Rather, you are given a monthly income and are expected to find your own housing and almost take care of yourself without really any help. And when you're trying to do that, at the same time as trying to do your exams and grade 12, a lot of this can be extremely overwhelming for students, especially students who don't necessarily have the skills or experience to be able to do this. So with this immense pressure in trying to just survive while at a time where you're expected to transition to a higher education or careers, a lot of these students end up not doing that at all. The stress gets to them, or they're just simply unable to handle all these different things, and they fall off the rails and end up not graduating. And when you don't graduate, again, the chances of you ending up in the justice system is so much higher. So when you really think about all of these different things overlapping each other, it's no surprise that so many Indigenous youth are going to the justice system, and why the stats are so high. Because when all these things happen together, it makes it really, really difficult for us to even succeed. And a lot of these kids don't know this. A lot of these kids don't know that's going to happen. I certainly didn't. My other sisters didn't. And whenever I meet someone in the foster care system, I try to tell them that they should expect that, because it's going to be really difficult. And I wish that I knew about this, or at least I had someone to talk to who experienced this as well. If I talk to a student who used to be in a foster care system and have them guide me throughout this process, guide me on how to regulate my emotions, how to regulate my work, and to balance all of these different things at the same time, then I feel like I would have done so much better. And even now, I'm still struggling really hard to even succeed. I'm still trying to graduate grade 12, and just because of all these different things that I'm forced to learn and how to do.
So going off of that, was there anyone in your life, Kagan and Chris, past or present, that you saw as a support, and what have they done to make you know that you can count on them?
Unfortunately for me, I I don't really have anyone. From a young age, I just told myself you can only trust yourself. Only you can look out for yourself. And unfortunately, I'm still in that mindset like 10 years later. I mean, sure, there's some people that I know can help me with some certain things. But other than that, I look out after myself and try to reach out from my own culture.
Mm-hmm. Like we've been mentioning this whole series, you know, the road to permanency is not a straight line, and it's not exactly completely like stable. You know, there's some bumps along the way, and it's a continued process. You know, I still look for it every day. You know, I have some people in my life, but of course there's always going to be that trust and that issue of fully ever finding it. So it definitely is, at the end of the day, relying on yourself. And like we mentioned last time, self-love.
Yes.
And just keep reminding yourself that you are worthy of that love.
Something that really helped me when I originally came here was very quickly I got involved with something called the Almighty. And I guess that gave me something that I can connect to and something to work towards, because it allowed me to have purpose and let me do things that I think would be beneficial to a lot of people. Just because I try to help people as much as I can, and having a platform and organization or place that I can go to be able to do that was immensely helpful, because it's something that I look forward to every single day. It's when I have a meeting coming up, I will literally count the days until we said meeting, because I enjoy it and I enjoy going to there, and it's something that makes me happy to be a part of and to look forward to, just because I know I will be able to talk to people that I care about. One of them being Chris. Like Chris, for example, is someone that I probably wouldn't really talk to or develop a connection with hadn't there been the YC. And I'm very glad I'm able to do something like that and to connect with these people that I otherwise wouldn't be able to, and be happy that I can. And that's something that's always been there for me, no matter where I moved or no matter what life circumstance has changed. The NYC, or just a place that I can go to where I can work and make change, is something that will always be there for me, and something that I can always look forward to and work towards and have a goal, and larger aspirations and dreams can come from it. Not to mention it provides me pathways and opportunities to branch out of my comfort zone and to do and meet new people that I otherwise wouldn't. Like, for example, if I wasn't affiliated with them, I would not be here, and I would not be able to meet Rita, Gracie, or even Sean. And so that's something that I would say I'm connected to, not the person, but rather this large entity or group of people that I can call home.
Thank you so much for sharing, and I really appreciate both Chris and Kegan for coming here today. I love that message of how just through this platform even we can find a connection and we can find permanency. Like, that's so beautiful, and I love that we're kind of coming to this conclusion. Like, even our listeners, like, they can find ways to advocate, they can find inspiration in today's podcast, and they can also find a sense of permanency in knowing that there's other people out here that are still struggling on their path, but they're still working towards it. So I just want to thank you guys for sharing your wisdom today and sharing your advocacy and all your inspiration. I really appreciate you. And I hope you guys join us next time.